A recorder joined.
Okay, well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the third installment of our CLC webinar series for 2016. The title for today's presentation is Working with Linguistically Diverse Populations. I am Kelsey Leonard, the Cultural and Linguistic Competence Coordinator for the Pennsylvania System of Care Partnership, and I'm just really excited to have you all attending today. If we could maybe just go around and say who's on the line and if you have anyone with you in your room or
join.
Some people may have a group. So from what I can see, maybe we'll just start with Barbara.
Hi, Barbara Huggins from the Child Welfare Resource Center.
Great, thank you. And again, too, if anyone has others in their room or would like a copy
of the Montgomery County
presentation, join. If you can write your email and name into the chat box, that would be great. The presentations are going to be available on our website, but I can also send you an email with them as an attachment. So we'll move on then to, I see, Jeffrey.
Jeffrey Gregro, Deputy Chief, Berks County Juvenile Probation Office.
Great, thank you. And Jennifer.
I'm a family member from Montgomery County System of Care.
And Jill, I think you just joined. I don't know if you can hear us. Okay, I think Jill's still signing on to the call. Do we have any Pennsylvania System of Care staff on the line?
Yes, hi. It's Pat Cambry. I'm really excited about your presentation today, Kelsey. Thank you.
Great, awesome. Thanks. Any other staff?
Hey, Kelsey, it's Lex.
Great to have you, Lex. And is there anyone else on the call that we missed or didn't get to introduce?
Kelsey, it's Jen Willard Miller. I'm here and just alone.
Okay. Great.
Hi, Jen.
Hi, Pat.
Join.
Did we miss anyone else? Oh, there's someone that joined. Hi. Who joined?
You must be on mute.
They must be on mute. So we'll get started. If there's anyone that has just joined the call, and really for all those that have joined the call, if you could just to type your name and your email address in the chat box, it allows us to keep accurate records of who attended and also make sure that you're continue to get our mailings for future events and CLC-specific content. So thank you again for joining today. This is the third installment of our webinar series.
Joe Kloss, Luzerne County.
Joined.
Working with Linguistically Diverse Populations. And just going to advance the slides. So this is just a recap that we did have two other series in our three-part series, one on the Pennsylvania System of Care Partnership CLC pilot project and another on mental health-friendly communities building faith-based SOC partnerships. And all of these presentations are going to be available on our website. If you would like me to send you an email with the presentations as an attachment, I'd be happy to do so, and you can just put your contact information into the chat box. Another bit of information, we are doing a second round of the CLC pilot project. We're calling it CLC Pilot 2.0. And we are looking for interested counties, whether you're part of the first cooperative agreement, expansion implementation, or just interested generally in system of care, and maybe this would be your entree into participation, to contact us to potentially serve as a pilot county for the 2.0 project. Some background on really what that looks like is we meet counties where you are at, in terms of your current CLC programming and planning, and we help you to conduct an assessment. We help you to develop a CLC plan, and then we help you through the implementation of one of the action items from that plan. So that's just some information on our second round of the CLC pilot project. And if you're interested in participating, please send me an email at leonardkt@upmc.edu. I have that email address at the back of the presentation as well. But we'd love for you to participate. We are looking to have our first introductory session the first week of June, and we are hoping to have all of our pilot counties confirmed so that we can launch at the June Learning Institute. So, as I said, I'm Kelsey Leonard. If you haven't met me, that's a little picture of me, so you can put a face to the name. So, when we talk about cultural and linguistic competence, we often are focusing just on the culture side, and in our conversations, we forget about the linguistic component of CLC. And that's why in this webinar series, we always make it one of the pillar presentations, so that we really can engage with the linguistic portion of CLC and make sure that it's always at the forefront and has equal ranking, if you want to call it that, with the other work that we're doing that might be CLC related.
Joined.
So an important part of that is, how do we define linguistic competence? Well, it's the capacity of an organization or its personnel to communicate effectively and convey information in a manner that is easily understood by diverse audiences, including persons of limited English proficiency, those who have low literacy skills or are not literate, and individuals with disabilities. So you can really see that linguistic competence cuts across a broad spectrum of some of the CLC work you probably already have been doing. And I think that, you know, it's definitely very critical to note that this incorporates individuals with disabilities, because I think sometimes that's an area that's not associated with linguistic competency, and it's really an integral part.
So
how can we get lost in translation? Well, one example that I like to show is, why did GM's Chevy Nova have poor sales when it was introduced in Latin America? Well, because
joined.
Nova means doesn't go, so nobody wanted a car that didn't move. And I think we have a lot of these same examples of moments of cultural bumps or hiccups that I like to call linguistic hiccups that make us lost in translation when we're trying to deliver care and when we're trying to work with youth and families within the system of care. And so how can we avoid these? And hopefully this presentation helps us to be put on the right path. So a key point for today's presentation is that language is a part of culture. So in everything that we're doing related to cultural and linguistic competence, language is integral to doing it effectively and in an efficient manner. And every language expresses ideas in different ways. So in the same way that we're adapting our programming to different cultures we may have in our counties, that adaptation also should be prevalent in terms of the different languages that we have within our counties. So it's important to start then with what are the languages that are spoken most frequently in Pennsylvania. Generally, we say that English is spoken by about 90% of the population within Pennsylvania. But you have to also take that with sort of a grain of salt, in the sense that maybe the statistical measurements measuring process is not getting all of the limited English proficient speakers or non-English speaking population within Pennsylvania. So the numbers may be somewhat off. And these numbers are also from 2010. So as our population continues to grow and gets more and more diverse, you're going to see that these numbers are consistently changing. And with that, it might be very heightened within your county. We definitely see regional variation. So that's really important, to sort of have a demographic understanding of the languages spoken within your county, because maybe across the state it's 90% of people, that English is spoken by 90% of people, but maybe within your county that number is only 80%. or that number is only, you know, 60%. And so that regional variation, I think, is really important to sort of to ascertain and to get a better understanding of. But then when we look at sort of the 10% of languages that are spoken outside of English, we see Spanish being the most prevalent, German next. Again, that has to do a lot, I assume, with our Pennsylvania Dutch and Amish communities, but we also have Pennsylvania Dutch on there, Italian, Chinese, French, Russian, Vietnamese, Korean, Polish, Arabic, Hindi. And there's actually 23% of the population that, or 23% of the languages are of other denominations, if you want to call it that. So there's really a robust richness of languages that are being spoken within Pennsylvania. And I know that also makes it somewhat complicated in our delivery of care, because we want to be sure that people are understanding the care that they are being offered and making conscious decisions in accepting that care. So what is health literacy? This is this other component of the definition for linguistic competence. Well, health literacy is the degree to which individuals have the capacity to obtain, process, and understand basic health information and services needed to make decisions about their health. And so it's dependent on both individual and systemic factors. So what are some of these factors? Well, we're looking at the communication skills of lay people and professionals, the knowledge of lay people and professionals of health topics, culture. So this is, you know, why health literacy is definitely a part of the definition of linguistic competence, demands of the healthcare and public health systems, and demands of the situation context. So all of these different factors can play into the an individual's ability to obtain, process, and understand basic health information, and to and are definitely determinants of an individual's health literacy. So moving on in terms of how these factors affect health literacy, well, people with limited or inaccurate knowledge about the body and the causes of disease or issues pertaining to mental health may not understand the relationship between lifestyle factors such as diet and exercise and health outcomes, and they may not recognize when they need to seek care. And I think this is really important in terms of that previous factor where it was listed that culture can affect health literacy. And so certain languages and cultural backgrounds may not identify certain risk factors as a need to seek care, and where other cultures would. And so being able to navigate those nuances is really important in assessing an individual's health literacy or in adapting to an individual's health literacy, because that's really what we're talking about is adaptation to better deliver care. And then health information can overwhelm people with advanced literacy skills. So if it can overwhelm people with advanced literacy skills, then think about how overwhelming that information can be to someone who may be processing this for the first time or has a limited health literacy background. Additionally, when we talk about health literacy being dependent on culture, culture affects health literacy in the sense that it affects people communicate and understand health information, how people think and feel about their health, when and from whom people seek care. So this is really a good component of why we had one of our sessions in this year's series on mental health-friendly communities, because we learned from Gigi Crowder in that session that oftentimes within the African-American community, the first step in seeking care, especially pertaining to issues around mental health, is to go to your faith-based leader, to go to your church, and to seek out guidance there first. And so being able to understand when and from whom diverse cultures and linguistic backgrounds seek care can help you to also identify some of those cultural brokers and community partners your county may want to engage with to better facilitate a more holistic approach to delivery of care. And then lastly, culture affects how people respond to recommendations for lifestyle change and treatment. So if you're not understanding their linguistic or cultural background and you're making recommendations that wouldn't fit their lifestyle or are sort of an antithesis to their cultural understandings or worldview, then that's going to be a disconnect and definitely a problem for the effective delivery of care. So what health literacy is not? I think this is important to know why it's different. So it's not using plain language. So plain language is a technique for communicating clearly. It's one tool for improving health literacy, but it's not health literacy. Another aspect is that health literacy is not cultural competency. Cultural competency is the ability of professionals to work cross-culturally. It can contribute to health literacy by improving communication and building trust. So when we talk about health literacy, this is a component of programming and systemic work that has to be developed that might use tools such as plain language or cultural competency to get your county there or to build improvements, but they're not the same. So why is health literacy important? Well, health literacy is important because it affects the people's ability to navigate the healthcare system, including locating providers and services and filling out forms. We'll get to a little bit later talking about the accessibility of forms and translation in the delivery of care. And then it also affects everyone's ability to share personal and health information with providers, engage in self-care and chronic disease management. So when we're talking about long-term care, really enabling individuals to build their health literacy in collaboration with your county and with the care that you're providing, but also to
joined
have individual agency in the development of their health literacy is important if they're managing for long-term care. It also helps people to adopt health-promoting behaviors such as exercising and eating healthy. It also helps them to act on health-related news and announcements and understanding directions on medication. Intermediate outcomes are better health outcomes, healthcare costs, quality of care. So when we see that there's an improvement in health literacy, we also see that there's an improvement in health outcomes, healthcare costs, and quality of care. And this may be of importance when you're trying to translate some of these big programmatic ideas in administrative conversations that really often can come down to budgeting and financial matters. So health literacy and quality of care. So health literacy affects the quality of care because good quality means providing patients or if we say clients, youth, families with appropriate services in a technically competent manner with good communication, shared decision making, and cultural sensitivity. And I think those are three really good tenets for us to take away from today's presentation, that when we're looking at health literacy, we're looking at what factors facilitate good communication, what factors facilitate shared decision making between diverse cultural backgrounds maybe that are represented in county staff versus clients, youth, family system partners, and then also allowing that to develop resources that really embrace cultural sensitivity, respect, and tolerance. There's this other aspect of health literacy and shame. So it's a very nuanced area where you have to go in with care and humility in saying that people with limited health literacy often report feeling a sense of shame about their skill level. So as we're developing programs to address these issues, we have to think of innovative ways to provide assistance that don't shame the individual or don't create an environment where they feel that sense of shame. And so individuals with poor literacy skills are often uncomfortable about being unable to read well, and they develop strategies to compensate. And so that's really important to note in sort of that front desk training you might have or in that first contact you might have with families and youth partners and clients in your delivery of care to say, okay, how can I set up programming or, intake that allows for individuals to feel safe and able to share their literacy skills without this added component of shame. And it may take time to develop those programs, but it's something to be cognizant of, that that even individuals might not feel comfortable sharing with you that they have poor literacy skills, so they develop these other strategies to compensate. And so you have to be cognizant of that and to figure out unique ways to navigate around that. So, and this leads into how do we measure health literacy. Some tasks that are used include sort of the clinical aspect, which is filling out a patient form. Again, you know, we talk about intake forms. And then we talk about prevention, so following guidelines for age-appropriate preventative health services, and then navigation of the healthcare system, so understanding what a health insurance plan will pay for, et cetera. You know, these are just examples within sort of these three domains. And I don't think that these three domains are exclusive. I think within your counties, within your different and varied programs, you know, even within juvenile justice, you might have another area, another domain there in addressing health literacy. And it's just something to consider is, you know, what would be your domains for measuring health literacy? Have you talked about that with your county leadership team or with other leadership advisory committees you might have within your county? You know, have you set out a process for that measurement or doing some level of assessment of health literacy? And then do you do it at the individual or organizational level? And I think that's important. And so sometimes when you're going through and then saying, okay, well, we have these domains, so we want to measure health literacy, then what is the actual measurement scale? And so it can, you know, one example is to say proficient can perform complex and challenging literacy activities. Intermediate can perform moderately challenging literacy activities. Basic can perform simple everyday literacy activities. And below basic can perform no more than the most simple and concrete literacy activities. And again, this could, you could adapt this model, you could change this model. This is not the only measurement scale for health literacy, but it's to give you an example of how others are thinking about going through this process. And I thought this was a really interesting statistic in terms of talking about factors that may contribute to health literacy. And demographic information that may contribute to health literacy. This is the percentage of adults in the below basic health literacy population. This is also from 2003, so the data is you know, I'm sure has changed, but it's good to kind of get a better understanding of how you could conduct your own assessment or monitoring. Now, just to remind you, below basic is can perform no more than the most simple and concrete literacy activities. And so in 2003, the percent in below basic population, so 51% of those that did not graduate from high school were in this category. So obviously there's a correlation between educational attainment. Did not speak English before starting school, 39%. Adults reporting poor health, so 10%. Hispanic adults, 35, those adults that are over the age of 65, so also there's a generational component here, adults without medical insurance, and then adults that maybe don't have access to the internet. So when we talk about broadband communications and, you know, there's this whole international movement right now around the internet being a human right. So when we start to talk about our human right to health and the health components that are integral to our society, the internet is now a really big determinant in our health and our access to the internet. And then also they have black adults having being 19% of the below basic population, and then also having a disability contributing to being in the percent of the below basic population. So I think that's a very interesting statistical graphic. So the bottom line, only 12% of adults had proficient health literacy. So that means that 9 out of the 10 adults that may be coming into contact with your county, with your system of care, really lack basic skills to manage their health care and to understand the care that you're delivering. So we all should be doing some type of health literacy work to build out our programming to address these needs. And then 14% of adults, about 30 million people, are in the below basic category, the information we presented in the previous slide in that graphic. and these adults are more likely to report their health as poor and are more likely to lack health insurance. Again, this data was prior to the Affordable Care Act, so it may have changed a bit, but it generally gives us an understanding or a better understanding that we need to develop programming that does look at health literacy and looks at health literacy within the context of system of care. So who is at risk? The problem of limited health literacy is greater among youth, those who are poor, people with limited education, minority populations, and persons with limited English proficiency. So how can we better advocate for health literacy improvement and programming within our counties? Well, hopefully the information that you saw previously on the earlier slides allows you to make the case for improving health literacy or for developing some targeted health literacy programming in your county. Health literacy, look to see, is it in your county's mission, in your system of care mission, in your strategic planning documents? Do you mention it anywhere? And if not, is there a reason for that? Was it just not something that was on the radar? And how could it be pulled in or adapted into your current mission or strategic planning? And then establish accountability for health literacy activities. You know, strongly consider doing some type of an assessment or measurement for health literacy. So before we move on, the next section of our presentation is on interpretation and translation services. Does anyone have any questions? Okay. Well, I'm not hearing any, but if you do think of a question, you can feel free to type it into the chat box, and we will field those as they come.
Kelsey, this is Pat. I do have a question. I couldn't take this off mute.
No problem.
I guess my question would be, if you're starting from nowhere, where would you suggest people begin? If they don't have any sense of this and they're, you know, a caseworker in children and youth, or they're a DNA worker or a probation officer, what's the first thing you start out with?
Well, I'm always a big advocate that you can't know where you're going unless you know where you're coming from. So with that, I think the first place to start is really to look at some of your current planning documents, your current mission, and see, do you actually have any programming that addresses health literacy? Is it a component or a domain that you looked at or that you are working towards addressing in your strategic goals that you've set out for your program? That would be the first step, or maybe a tangential step in coordinated with understanding your demographics. So health literacy, we know, is greatly tied to, as I said, we can go back to the previous who is at risk. We know that there's a problem of limited health literacy is greater among youth, those who are poor, people with limited education, minority populations, and limited English proficiency. So really trying to get an understanding of your demographics. How many youth are you serving? What's their economic background? What's their educational background? What's the minority population makeup in your county? And again, what is the linguistic diversity within your county? And I think if you can understand those five areas, even if in its most basic form, you can start to build from there to address some of these problems. The only other thing I would say with that is maybe you've already had an issue related to health literacy. So maybe there's been some type of a cultural bump or hiccup or a lost in translation moment like the NOVA, and you use that as your catalyst to be able to build out programming so that it doesn't happen again. And I think that's where I would start.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. So again, yes, thank you for that question. And if you, if anyone thinks of any other questions, feel free to type them into the chat box. So we move on then to interpretation. So high quality accessibility to system of care for non-English speaking or limited English proficient populations so that the care youth and families receive will lead to similar quality of care delivery of English speakers and improved health outcomes. So when we talk about interpretation within system of care, this is one of the desired outcomes that we would like to see. So some initial steps that we would recommend, this kind of gets to your question as well, Pat, mapping out your gaps. So understand your county linguistic demographics.
Joined.
As I said, the linguistic information I presented was across the state, but there definitely are regional pockets where you may have greater linguistic diversity than is represented statewide. Also define the existing solutions, the means of language accessibility currently used. So like we said, in, you know, where are you currently in defining health literacy, if at all? Where are you currently in your language accessibility programming? Do you offer interpretation services, and what do those look like? How do you facilitate those services? And then define the scope of the desired solution. So does the percentage of youth and families turning to the county require the employment of an in-house staff, interpreters, remote language access, which can be by telephone or video, or the use of bilingual employees that have undergone adequate medical interpreting training? So these are three different components to potentially address youth and families that are limited English proficient or are in need of linguistic services. And maybe you need all three in your county. Maybe you need one. Maybe at this point in time you don't need any, but you want to have a backup plan to be able to operationalize one of them at any point in time. That's what we mean by defining the scope of your solution. So follow-up activities can be to establish a pool of interpreters. So language access will be achieved through the use of one or more of the following ways: the employment of interpreters, contracting with interpreting services, or of bilingual employees and volunteers who received adequate training in interpreting. So that's, I may bring this up again, but when you are utilizing employees in dual services, so maybe they are in the sense that they're not just hired to be interpreters, they are youth support partner, but are also bilingual. The only way that you can list them as a bilingual employee is if they've undergone adequate training and been tested. And then you can list that as another sort of certification or qualification of that employee. But you can't just hire someone who says that they are Spanish proficient and then list them as a bilingual employee and allow them to do translation or interpretation services for you without having them tested. It creates a legal liability and an insurance liability, and you're not actually sure if what that person has told you about their proficiency is accurate. Because it may not be out of a malicious intent. It just may be the standards of interpretation set at the by the profession may not be the same standards that the person who's saying they're proficient is actually at. So that's why you need to have them tested or undergo adequate training that results in certification. So establish and integrate a policy for interpretation services, disseminate knowledge regarding language access to all. So that's the biggest gap we often see, is counties have language accessibility services, but oftentimes youth and families don't realize that you have it, and they would have rather have had you spoken to them or utilized those language accessibility services if they had known. And so we really have to bridge that gap of, so if you have language accessibility services, what are you doing to make sure that everyone that comes in for care or for services knows that those are available to them? And then have some type of CLC training on the use of interpreters. So maybe you have staff are not interpreters themselves or are not bilingual certified interpreters, and so then they are contracting out for the use of interpreters. They need to be trained on that, because not a lot of people know about the different training certifications and testing that is required for the proper delivery of language accessibility services. So then we move on to the recommended maintenance activities. Continually assess the availability of language access relative to demand. So this could be maybe an annual assessment, maybe it's a biennial assessment, maybe you do one every 6 months. That's up to you. But you want to assess the impact of the various means of language access on the delivery of care. And also to have some type of demographic understanding and continual updating of your linguistic diversity baseline. So as I said, you know, our population is constantly changing and evolving, and so that's really important. We seem we have a question. I just want to turn to that, make sure we get to that. So one of the questions we have is, what should an employee do if they have been given a case for translation and have expressed their discomfort with doing such? That's a great question, and really, hopefully you can take some of the information today and say and say to your administration, you know, I don't have the proper certifications to do this translation. I think that it would be better served, you know, the youth or family would be better served if we utilized this other outside contractor or this other resource available. That is something too, where if you're having an issue in terms of the process utilized for translation and interpretation services at the state level as CLC coordinator, you know, I can you know, potentially offer some assistance in whether it's, you know, writing an email for clarification or doing some type of a training, but I would encourage you to assert, if possible, to that uncomfort in sort of as diplomatic a way that you can. And usually that's by saying, oh, there's this new standard, and it's not really new, but it will help you in articulating your case. But there is a national standard that says that for translation services to be provided, you need to have this certification and you need to have done this testing, and I haven't done that. So it's really, it's definitely in the best interest of our youth or family to contract this service out or to look for someone else, maybe within staff, who has more comfort with it and does have those certifications and testing and has met those testing requirements. Does that help? Is there anything else related to that question that I could expand on? Okay. Well, if you think of something, I know we're probably on mute, feel free to type that into the chat box. But it's a great question, and it's definitely something that a lot of staff do face. But, you know, if it does come down to it, you know, it really is, you can make your case by saying this is a legal requirement and an insurance liability, because if you're uncomfortable and you know, and that uncomfort leads to, you know, a poor translation or an inaccurate translation that leads to, you know, some greater falter in the delivery of care, you know, that can come back to be a liability on the county or program or organization who told you to do that. And we don't want that. You know, we don't want those cultural bumps or hiccups to turn into mountains. So that's, I hope that helps. So as we move on in terms of maintenance activities, if possible, assess the quality of the interpreting of by professional interpreters. So again, that's where we say that, you know, you can bring in professional interpreters, maybe to do a training, to do testing and certifications for your staff if need be. Monitor the actual use of interpreting with the youth and family served, and So request youth and family feedback is really what we're getting at, and ask them to say, how are we doing on our language accessibility services? And then setting a feedback and control mechanism of the interpreter's work. So you don't want interpreters and translators to just be off on an island doing their own thing. You know, they should be held responsible. They should be, you know, be tested or brought in for meetings on a, you know, quarterly or annual basis, and you want their feedback too, because they can say, hey, this is working really well, or, you know, we had some issues with, you know, this one youth or family case that you gave us specifically because, you know, you listed it as Spanish, but it was actually this unique dialect within Spanish, and we had real trouble facilitating proper communication. And so you want to make sure that quality control is there so that you can make sure that you're providing the proper services and the best services you can. And if you're subcontracting services, you want to make sure that, you know, what you're paying for is actually what's being delivered. Okay, so if we move on then, written translation. So written translation or interpretation and translation are different. They're not the same thing. And so I often say written translation. So when we talk about translation services, it is the literal word-for-word translation and often is written from one language to another. Interpretation is does not have to be word-for-word. So that's important to note. But for written translation, we look at signature consent forms available in other languages, county materials available in common languages, allow for cultural adaptations. Again, that could be a dialect component, use of expert medical translators, and evaluation and quality control. So we've talked a bit about that, but again, this is what we're looking for within translation. I would just point out that when we say use of expert translators, again, if you're going to say that something has been translated into Spanish, if you use a software program, then you should ensure, you should also have someone within the language that it's been translated to review those documents to make sure they're accurate, because software programs notoriously have problems, especially if you're using free software programs. We do not encourage, nor would we suggest, based on, again, legal and insurance liability issues, for you to use a consent form that's been translated to a free software program. It's just, it's not going to be good for anyone, and they're notoriously wrong, especially because we're dealing with very nuanced terminology when we're looking at mental health and system of care work. So recommended initial steps when we're looking at translation services. We want to map out all the forms in the organization in order of importance to patients or to youth and families. So you may not be able to translate all of your forms currently, but maybe you can start to map them out and phase each of the different into different sections, forms for translation. So you have phase one forms, phase two forms, phase three forms. And over a timeline of maybe a year or 2 years, you move sequentially to have all of your forms translated. Trying to do all forms at once is definitely possible, but it's resource intensive and may not be the best fit for your county depending on your size and the demographics of your youth and family served. Classify the forms according to how crucial they are. Identify potential translation professionals, and then locate forms and documents that have been translated by other entities and can be adapted. So, and we may be able to assist you with that if you're looking for certain forms that may have already been translated. York County has done extensive work in translating system of care documents. So they're a great resource, and we can always put you in touch with someone from there if you're looking for specific forms. Again, the original English material should also be adapted to the level of the target audience's health literacy. So when we were asking questions about what's my first step, well, maybe you should look at some of the materials you currently have and have put together some type of an assessment or measuring scale to say, what's the health literacy of this brochure we hand out, you know, to two-thirds of our clients? Is it really accessible to them? And if you haven't asked that question, then maybe that's a good first step, is just to say, hey, have we looked at the health literacy level of our materials? Do we have, you know, do we have a ranking? You know, you could make a fun, like clip art scale for your health literacy. So maybe it has, you know, it could be fruit or something, apples and oranges and watermelons, and that's the scale that you put on each of your brochures. For an apple means this is, you know, health literacy
certified for the below basic level, or, you know, this other fruit is for the advanced level. That's just something to consider. And it could, again, that's just throwing out ideas, but that's to show you that there's all these different levels of programming that can be adapted to improve these different domains for linguistic competence. So, some recommended follow-up activities: translate all of the forms that require the patient's signature using family signature. The organization will enable every youth and family to sign, to choose the language of the form they sign. So these are, you know, further down the line, if this, you know, if you've not, if you haven't started to translate forms, further down the line, you might want to think about, you know, do we have forms available in every language, or do we have a process to enable us to make forms available in every language? And then every new form relevant to your target audience will be sent for translation into the target languages. So again, when we say target audience, that's something that you're going to develop after after conducting an assessment and having determined what your demographic baseline is. So what's the linguistic diversity in your county? And then you'll know your target audience, because the target audience of Montgomery County might be very different from Philadelphia or Allegheny County or Northumberland, et cetera, because we know that each of your counties are unique and have some regional diversity. So maintenance activities, assessment, as I said, all the translated documents should be easily accessible from the organization's data system. So that's something, too, where we've heard from counties and from different partners that you don't always share data systems, like your systems are not connected. So figuring out where you're going to house translated documents so that they're easily accessible to a broad spectrum of county representatives or county staff is a great concern. And it might not be something you can do initially, but you want to have some type of long-term plan to enable that accessibility. And then consider sharing your translated documents with us at the state level, the state implementation team, and then we can share it with other SOC counties. So similar to the great work that York has done, they've been able to share some of their documents through our facilitation at the state level. And then just making sure that you're doing ongoing monitoring of the availability of translated material. You know, populations change, so then your materials are going to need to change. So some just additional information on linguistic competence. I mentioned that there's literal translation is the strict adherence to the original text, composition, and grammatical structure. Adaptation is replacing cultural or social elements from the original text. First, in considering the relevance of the content to your target group. So when we're looking at translation, you know, these are different areas within written translation. Translators do not usually adapt materials to make them culturally competent. Just because a document is translated doesn't mean it's culturally competent. So I think that's a really important component of this conversation, is that linguistic and cultural competence go together. So although you've translated something, you also might want to, like where I said, have someone who is from that, who speaks that language or is from that target population, review the documents, review what you've translated, and ask them, you know, is this, you know, does this meet health literacy for you? Do you find this to be culturally competent for you? And you can put together a working group of community members from those target populations to review some of these documents. And you're, you know, and this is when you're just sort of getting it off the ground. And then, you know, then you'll be able to pinpoint later on maybe who are some targeted individuals that you can partner with in the future. But that's a really good sort of feedback, quality improvement process to have. And then we strongly recommend not using untrained translators. Again, this is where we talked about staff members that speak a target language, but they're, you know, they haven't been certified. Language support. So, you know, you want to assess your linguistic resource inventory. So do you have translation services? Do you have interpreting services? Do you have bilingual staff? How do you evaluate staff members' language proficiency? So it's really critical. You know, maybe right now you don't know if a staff that's listed as bilingual has actually been had their proficiency evaluated, or maybe you just list them if they say that they're bilingual, and you should really have a protocol in place for establishing that bilingual listing. Some factors to consider for translation of written documents. Do we have a partner for translation services? If you're using in-house staff, this goes back to the question raised earlier. Do they have ATA certification? Are there indirect costs with that? Errors or missing insurance. So again, if you're using in-house staff and not a subcontracting translation service that probably already has errors or omission insurance, you should ask whether your county has that. Because if you make a mistake, or then they can be held liable, you can be held liable, and you just want to ensure that you have the proper protocol in place to prevent any of those major grievances. And then the necessary industry standard translation tool. So if you're using software, does it meet industry standards? Questions to ask for quality translation services. So if you're going to contract out, what are some questions that you should ask? Does the provider use translation memory tools? Are there hidden costs? Does the provider offer culturally appropriate services? So, you know, do they understand cultural competence, or have they never heard of that? That's probably a red flag if they've never heard of cultural competency, that their translation services probably aren't going to be the most effective. Can the provider assist with literacy issues? Some providers can. Some maybe don't have a great extent of experience working in health literacy. And then am I protected? So, again, that error omissions question, do they have error omissions insurance or some type of process in place if they translate something improperly? Factors to consider for interpretation. Do we have a partner for interpreting services? If it's a phone or video service, is it available 24/7? Do we have access information readily available? So again, you know, do youth and families know that interpretation services are available? And then do you list volunteer interpreters, bilingual staff available for emergencies? And so that could be a youth mental health first aid emergency, a school emergency, it could be a natural disaster. Thinking about ways that you can partner with other areas of social services within your county. And then factors to consider for your bilingual staff, we've talked about this, but have staff members been tested? You know, is there proficiency, written proficiency or oral proficiency? You can also establish an incentive or recognition program for staff that will go through testing. So if they've listed themselves as bilingual and you can potentially pay for their testing to have them certified and then have that listed on their employment record that they are bilingual and certified, then that can be an incentive. Or you can, you know, develop some other type of recognition program. Making sure you have a roster of those individuals that have been tested or evaluated for proficiency. And then proficiency does not equal interpreting or translation ability. So, again, the terms that we use are important. If someone says they're proficient, that doesn't necessarily mean that they are meeting industry standards for interpretation or translation skills. So, again, these are just some remaining guidelines for translation. And I wanted to give you some information about a training opportunity. It's called the Mental Health Interpreter Training. It's out of Colorado. This is something, it's a three-day training there's a three-day training and a one-day training you can potentially send staff to. There might be, if you contact them, they might have one that's more regional within Pennsylvania, but it's the National Asian American and Pacific Islander Mental Health Association and the National Latino Behavior Health and Mental Health Association. Mental health interpreter training. So it's a cooperative program between these two minority-serving mental and behavioral health associations, and they have set up an intensive training of interpreters for mental health, which is really great because when you are going to start to reach out to interpretation or translation services, they may not have experience working in mental health. And so finding a software program that has an adaptive dictionary or memory tools to be able to build out words that are specific to system of care or to your mental health services or youth services, family services, it will be really important. And so finding a training like this that is mental health specific, behavioral health specific, is somewhat unique. So it can give you a little bit of the purpose of this training, benefits. And again, this will be available on our website, but I'm just conscious of time and we're leaving a few minutes for questions. They have a bilingual interpreter module. So this is designed to support bilingual, bicultural individuals interested in enhancing their skills. So again, this could be something that you could even adapt. If you have a very large portion of your staff that is being listed currently as bilingual, maybe you want to invest the resources and the time to do a certification module similar to this. And they have a monolingual provider module. And then this is their contact information and website for that training. So lastly, I just wanted to let you know what our PA SOC county is doing. Well, last year, Northumberland did a front desk training where they incorporated introductory Spanish language skills. So with that, the front desk training is basically to provide information to or it's to provide staff with the resources to be able to be more culturally competent in greeting and doing that first initial intake for youth and families. And they adapted that training to provide Spanish introductory Spanish language skills as well. And so that was really unique. We also, as I mentioned, for York County, they purchased a translation software with adaptive dictionary and have been building out that dictionary and translating forms and documents facilitate their target population, predominantly Spanish-speaking individuals. And they also, like I said, formed a committee to review those documents to make sure that they were culturally competent and not just linguistically competent. There are also some counties that are currently working with cultural brokers and community partners to facilitate trainings and language partnerships, and so that's always something you can do. And so, you know, before we end, I just wanted to see if there were additional questions that people had, and if any of your counties were doing similar work or had considered doing some type of linguistic competency work and wanted to share that information.
Hey, Kelsey, I wanted to give a minute for other counties, but I see we have, like, a few minutes left here. My question would be, hearing feedback from the first three counties and the changes they made culturally due to the pilot project, do you feel like if other counties wanted to come on board with the pilot 2.0, that there's a way that we could have some sort of open space meeting, county peer-to-peer support things so that the new counties could talk to the first round and see what their experiences were and maybe kind of help guide them through the process a little bit?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I definitely think we are hoping to do that. We have built into Pilot 2.0 for York County, who was one of our original pilot counties, to participate. So we will have sort of that experienced county there to offer guidance and background on what they did in the first pilot. And they're also going to be working through the Pilot 2.0 to do another action item on their county plan. So that will be built in, but I definitely agree with you that I think having another meeting probably halfway through because we'd want some of the new counties to be able to sort of get their process underway and to understand the pilot and get their probably assessment underway before we have a larger joint meeting. But I think that's a great idea of having the first round of counties and the second round of counties come together and share their experiences thus far.
Okay, cool.
Well, that does lead us into questions, and just a reminder that cultural competence and linguistic competence are a life's journey, not a destination. So I often say this isn't a checklist where you have to go through and mark things off, but if there is something from today's presentation or the other presentations in the series that have sparked your interest and sort of get you moving on that journey, that's important, and that's then we find that to be a great success. And so we're here to help you. Feel free to contact me at leonardkt@upmc.edu if you have any questions. If you are interested in joining our state CLC subcommittee, which does a lot of the planning for the state level programming around CLC. We're having a meeting at the 2016 Learning Institute in State College Monday, June 19th at 3:15 p.m. And we would love for you to potentially to come and join us and get to sort of see what we do. And then if you, you know, are considering maybe participating as a member for 2016-2017, we would love to have you. And so that's the conclusion of our presentation for today. Again, here is my contact information. We'll be posting the webinar and audio recording on our website. And we just want to thank you for participating and taking part in today. And I will remain on the line for a few moments if anyone has any additional questions they'd like to ask.
Left.
Thanks very much, Kelsey. You did an awful lot of work in preparing this, and your expertise
left
shown through. So thank you.
Oh, thanks, Pat.
Left.
We had a nice turnout today.
Yeah,
we did. Sharon Verity in Montgomery County.
And some great questions.
Left.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Claus, Luzerne County.
Left.
Fayette County.
Left. Left.
Jen Willard Miller.
Left.
Kay Lipsitz.
Left.
Lex.
Join.